More and more algorithms are part of life as we know it. This is the computer coding that has pluses and minuses across our society, from helping us queue up our Netflix to the work of taking down potential terrorists. We're going deep and wide on algorithms here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hannah Fry is an associate professor in the mathematics of cities at the Center for Advanced Analysis at University College London. She's also a contributor and presenter for the BBC and author of the book Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. Hannah, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, algorithms, to borrow your words, are the invisible pieces of code that form the gears and cogs of the modern machine age. Give us a sense of how far-reaching algorithms are into our lives.
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely everywhere. I think there are the obvious ones that we know about, you know, Amazon's recommendation engine or Netflix telling us what films we should watch or Google telling us what web pages link to the things that we're looking for, the search terms that we're looking for. But I don't think that we necessarily realize just how much they're now, they've sort of infiltrated every other aspect of our lives. So, you know, you find these things now in hospitals, you find them in courtrooms, in police stations, in schools, you find them essentially anywhere that people are trying to work out anything. We've slowly sort of given up more and more control and power to algorithms. Sometimes that's a very good thing, and sometimes it's not quite a good thing.
And we tend to use the word algorithm in lots of different situations. Help us understand what it is, because in the most basic sense, give us a definition, a foundation.
Yeah, so I sort of think in a way, the reason why the word algorithm doesn't really convey much meaning is because it doesn't really mean very much, if I'm totally honest. It's this really broad umbrella term. It's basically the word that you use to describe anything that takes you from some kind of input via some series of logical steps to some kind of output, right? So that could be if you stop someone in the street and ask them for directions and they say, go down the road, take a left there, and then carry on for three blocks and then take a right. I mean, essentially, they're giving you an algorithm in that process. Or, you know, a cake recipe is an example of an algorithm where your input there is all of the ingredients that you start off with. And your logical process is the steps of the recipe itself. And then your output at the end that you get is kind of a cake. But the way that people use the words more generally is they're talking about processes that happen inside a computer where the input tends to be our data based on us, things that we're doing, data that's been collected about us and how we behave, the things that we like, the things that we do. And that logical process is often trying to work out something about us so that you can make a prediction about what we're going to then go on to do in the future or what would work best based on how we'll behave.
So algorithm, though, is more of an umbrella term. And then underneath that umbrella, there are four kinds of algorithms. Can you help us understand the flavors a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of a computer scientist or, you know, computer scientists haven't got this sort of standard definition of like different categories of algorithm. But you can think of them, if it's useful, you can think of them as doing particular kinds of things, right? So you can think of algorithms that perhaps are prioritizing things. So Google search algorithms are a really great example of this. You put in your keywords and what it does is it prioritizes the entire web for you and puts it into an ordered list so that the top of the list is the thing that it thinks matches your search as much as possible. Lots of algorithms that are trying to sell you stuff do this as well, you know, thinking of everything that you want, that you might want to buy, kind of, you know, can say, watch this film or read this book or, you know, buy this object. There are also algorithms that filter things. So, for instance, if you have a sat nav or your GPS,
satellite navigation.
Uh-huh. Sorry, forgive me. Very British of me. I'm sorry. Your satellite navigation. When you put in where you want to go, of course, between A to B, there are all kinds of different routes that you could potentially take. But what that algorithm is doing is it's filtering through all those different possibilities for you and coming up with just one answer for you, saying, you know, take this particular route. There are also algorithms that find connections between lots of different things. So this might be, the Amazon recommends. It's like people who bought this item before also bought this stuff. So what it's doing there is it's forging a connection between you and other people like you. It's kind of finding similarities. And then there's also sort of classification algorithms, which look at you as an individual or a piece of data, and then they classify you as a particular type of person. So these are the algorithms that, you know, when I sort of hit my early 30s, I was suddenly swamped on the internet by algorithms advertising diamond rings, right? Because of course, if you're in your early 30s, you must be able to classify that sort of female as someone who wants to get married, right? So these are the classification algorithms that you have to blame for, you know, those kind of adverts that you get when you wander around online.
Mathematician Hannah Fry is author of the book Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. She's taking us on a journey of how algorithms work and how they're increasingly used in medicine, criminal justice, in cars, in lots of areas of our life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What puzzles you about algorithms that you use, or even the ones you don't even realize you're using? Are you ever taken aback by how much your computer or phone seems to know about you? Are you aware of the ads that pop up for you on Facebook, or the coupons the grocery store spits out for you at the checkout? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Hannah, let's talk a little bit about how we interact with the algorithms going on behind us, on the back end of our lives, so to speak. How do algorithms interact with humans?
So in lots of different ways. I mean, there's the ones that are sort of very front and center that you're seeing, whenever you sort of sit down in front of a computer, and it's just a whole box of algorithms, really. But there are ones that are operating behind the scenes, too. So, increasingly we're having algorithms that are used in places like courtrooms, for instance, very controversially in some cases, algorithms that are used to predict whether someone will go on to commit a crime in future. And these algorithms, they're used by judges to decide who should be awarded bail. And in some cases, they're also used to decide how long someone's sentence should be. And in a way, they're doing the same thing that algorithms that are used online to kind of make predictions about what you might buy or what you might like to watch. It's similar ideas behind the scenes, but they're obviously kind of taking them in a different direction having much greater impact in some ways on potentially in people's lives. That's what we're seeing a lot more of, algorithms that are being used to decide on school buses, on their sort of the routes that school buses should take. There was a very big example of that in Boston quite recently. In hospitals too, algorithms that are used by doctors to help them in their diagnoses, in trying to decide who does and who doesn't have cancer, for example. So, I mean, I think that every possible situation that you can imagine in which a human might be trying to make a decision, we're seeing algorithms slowly sort of take on that role.
Not inherently bad, but we often hear about algorithms, the bad ones, of course, the things that have just gone wrong. If algorithms are, we're flawed and we're unfair human beings, we're mortals and we're creating these algorithms, how can they be fair? I mean, how can they be just?
Well, I mean, I think you're totally right. But then I also think that if you leave algorithms to one side for a moment, I've spent quite a long time trying to think of a single system in the world that is perfectly fair. Anything in education or healthcare and criminal justice, anything that's perfectly, perfectly fair. And I don't think there is anything. I don't think that algorithms are going to come and suddenly sweep in and make everything suddenly fair. They're subject to the same flaws that humans are.
Mathematician Hannah Fry's book is Hello World. Getting your insights, your questions on algorithms, 800-642-1234. Do you have a story to share about how algorithms have touched your life, maybe in a medical diagnosis, maybe in a driverless car? Let's talk about it. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Algorithms are all around us. They are instructions for computers to solve a problem or complete a task. And they have issues, problems with privacy, human bias, human error. There's accountability, there's transparency issues to think about. But they can do a world of good, saving lives, making things easier, bringing order to chaos. The new book is Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. Author Hannah Fry stays with us. She's an associate professor in the mathematics of cities at the Center for Advanced Analysis at University College London. Getting your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about algorithms and how they work? Are you ever taken aback by how much your computer or phone seems to know about you? You can call in. You can also email at ideas@wpr.org. Hannah, let's look at data for a moment. Data collection, just looking at shopping habits, for instance, can tell a lot about a person. You talked about in the 30s and getting ads about diamond rings. And some people may recall the time that a father in Minnesota went into a Target store and demanded to see a manager because he was upset that his teenage daughter received pregnancy coupons in the mail. And he was concerned that they were normalizing teenage pregnancy. And it came out later that his daughter was pregnant and that Target's algorithm to determine whether a customer was expecting was correct. So what do we take away from this story?
It's just incredible, isn't it? Just how much can be inferred about us just from very simple things like our shopping habits. I had a conversation with a chief data officer of a British company who sells home insurance not very long ago. And they have the loyalty card data of all of their customers. They know what people are claiming for on their insurance, and they know what they're buying in the supermarket, in the grocery store. And they'd worked out that people who were home cooks were less likely to make claims on their home insurance, which seems, I guess you wouldn't guess that, but once you know it, it sort of makes sense, right? If you're kind of the sort of person who'll spend an entire day cooking a meal, you're also going to be quite house proud, probably not bump into many accidents in your own home. But the question is, how do you know if someone's a home cook? So this group, they worked out that there was one item in people's baskets that was a real giveaway, one item that people were buying that really gave them away as a home cook. And it was fresh fennel, which I think is really extraordinary. This idea that, you know, you have this one item that you're buying and suddenly it sort of triggers this whole thing for you. But it is just astonishing the amount that you can work out about people. So there was a government report a couple of years ago about companies called data brokers, who essentially, they are the people who collect information on us, and they're the ones who infer from that information things about us. And there was a list of all of this, all of the things that you can work out about someone online, right? And it was just incredible. So it's things like whether your parents were divorced when you were young, whether you've had a miscarriage, whether you've had an abortion, your true sexuality and your declared sexuality, whether you're gullible, whether you're, all kinds of just really, really personal stuff that you don't really necessarily know that you're giving away, but because the way that you're behaving online, you're giving enough clues that someone else can work out those things about you.
What does this all mean for privacy?
Well, it's not good, I think, is the answer. I mean, there are some people who say that they think privacy is dead, and I sort of think that they're probably right. I mean, I went to something called a crypto party while I was researching this book, which is essentially, it's a group of people who try and they care a lot about your privacy, and they try and teach people how to keep their privacy while they're online. And essentially, the lengths that you have to go to sort of hold on to who you are without other people knowing who you are, they're just extraordinary. I mean, these people were basically saying you should have your own version of a computer, your own operating system on a little USB stick that disappears with you as you leave. So not just your browser, not just, you know, how you're logging in online, your whole operating system, your whole kind of computer should exist on a USB stick and disappear when you're finished. And that's the kind of the lengths that you have to go to maintain this level of privacy. And, you know, I sort of, I was at this party looking around and, you know, I was sort of there researching the book, but I couldn't help but wonder what all the other people who were there at this party had to hide, you know, that they were so concerned that they would go to those kind of extents. But unless you are prepared to go to those sort of levels, unless you really are prepared to not live your life online, then, you know, I think that, you know, a part of that is that we are inevitably giving up all kinds of information about who we are, deeply personal information too.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Michael joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Michael. What's your question?
Hi. So you're talking a lot about sort of how integral algorithms are to our like personalities online and what they can know about us. I just wanted to know kind of about other things that are integral to our lives. So like the power grid, do algorithms have any sort of control over where power goes or deciding where power might go during like a peak time of power, like during summer or something like that?
Yeah, Michael.
Power is in electricity.
Yeah, like the power grid.
Yeah, how smart are our electric grids?
Yeah, so that, I mean, there are certainly plans to make them incredibly smart because, you know, as I'm sure you well know, there are these sort of surges and troughs in the way that people use power, and kind of managing against those is very tricky. So, I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but I would be surprised if there weren't algorithms running behind the scenes already trying to make sure that things stayed as smooth as possible. But there are certainly plans to make to build in artificial intelligence into all of these different kind of things. There was a big project quite recently by DeepMind, who are the sort of artificial intelligence arm of Google, and they went into a big sort of warehouse and took over the control of the energy in that warehouse, trying to make it much more efficient. And this particular warehouse, it needed a lot of cooling, right? So there were kind of lots of fridges and fans and all of these different kind of cooling equipment that needed to be turned on and off at different times. And the artificial intelligence did astonishingly well at reducing the amount of energy that was being used in this warehouse, like incredibly well. I mean, the graph is like, sort of blows you away, just this drop as soon as you hand over control to the artificial intelligence. So I think that we're going to be seeing more and more of that you know, we're building in these smarter systems to try and make sure that energy usage is as sustainable as possible. So both in terms of, you know, how much we're using and where it goes. So, yeah, I think more and more we'll see that.
Michael, thanks so much for the call. Hannah, is there any kind of regulation as we talk about data brokers and as we make our digital footprints each day in the choices we make, in the information we hand over in our daily routine? Is there any regulation of data brokers?
Well, unfortunately, it's not very much, to be honest. I mean, I think that we've sort of been living in the Wild West, really, in terms of what people can harvest, what people can manipulate, and what people are allowed to use that for. There's very, very little by way of regulation. In Europe, we're at a slight advantage. We have something called GDPR that came in this year, which is this. It sounds like an incredibly boring bit of legislation, but it's quite a powerful step in the right direction. The idea is that you put a little bit of power and control back into the hands of the individual. They have a little bit more control over who owns their data, and they can sort of stop people from you know, manipulating it if they want to. Unfortunately, as has what's really happened, as any of your listeners who have frequented European sites may well have realized, is that we're just basically all being killed by terms and conditions. It's sort of death by boredom. You know, hidden in those terms and conditions is that we're sort of waiving our rights to all of control of our data. And we're just so sick of them that people are just kind of ticking agree to everything, just I want to kind of get on with my life. So it's this tricky balance really between consent and real consent, where you're really aware of what you're consenting to, and then also, you know, having governments take an active role in this. But we're seeing slowly steps in the right direction, but I mean, it's incredible what people have been able to get away with. Incredible, I think.
Slow steps in the right direction. What are some of those steps that you're seeing that are helping us get a handle on this?
Well, there are lots of groups who are really talking about this a lot and kind of lobbying government to just put a little bit more power back into the hands of the individual. And there are lots of in the kind of communities where, you know, people are building algorithms, people are building artificial intelligence. People are really starting to think very, very seriously about the ethics of what they're doing. You know, I think companies like Facebook, for example, have come into a lot of criticism. This is not stuff that's going unnoticed. I mean, there was an article, I think, in the New York Times yesterday, perhaps, maybe the day before, about how Facebook was giving away our private messages to different companies to use essentially, you know, for their own profit. And I think that they're not getting away without criticism here. You know, there are people who are being hauled in front of government panels and being asked to answer for what their companies have been doing. And I think the more and more that we see of that, the more in the right direction we're heading.
The book is Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. We're going behind the scenes to understand the human applications, where they do good, where they fall short, and where we have more work to do to get better outcomes for humanity. Mathematician and author Hannah Fry stays with us to tell us these stories. Your questions, your stories are welcome. 800-642-1234. What adjustments have you made to the information you put online? What apps or features of algorithms do you love? Let's talk about it. Give us a call or email ideas at WPR.org. News is next. Our conversation continues on the Ideas Network. Algorithms augment our lives in subtle and some obvious ways. We're learning how they work across society, in our hospitals, in our grocery stores, our courtrooms, police stations, in our cars, on the navigation. Computer coding is silently working in the background, and algorithms are beside us navigating our world even when we don't really know it. We're talking about how we set technology up to work for us. Here on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mathematician Hannah Fry stays with us. Her new book is Hello World, Being Behind Human in the Age of Algorithms. Do you see a human side to algorithmic thinking? Have you seen the positive outcomes of algorithms? And where are algorithms headed in the industry that you work in from your vantage point at work? Call in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Hannah, let's look at algorithms in the justice system. Dig in more deeply there. You write about how judges who determine bail and sentencing are pretty inconsistent, not only compared to how other judges rule, but also with themselves. Can you walk us through what some of the studies have found?
Yeah, so I mean, if there is one job in the world where you want your human to be as sort of cold and logical and immune from bias and immune from error as possible, it's in a judge, right? But you know, a lot of the evidence suggests that judges, really humans in general, just can't make consistent decisions at all, really. We're really bad at it. So there's some evidence that shows that if you take the same case to a different judge, then you'll often get a different answer. If you take the same case to the same judge on a different day, you'll also often get a different answer. There's evidence that shows that, for example, judges who have daughters are much stricter in cases that involve violence against women. There's some evidence that shows, actually my favorite of all, is that judges tend to be a lot stricter in towns where the local sports team has lost recently. Mm. Which I think, you know, illustrates just how our mood kind of changes things. But there's even, you know, evidence to show that judges don't like giving the same response too many times in a row. So if three bail cases before you have been successful, your chances of having a successful case will then drop. You know, there's all kinds of evidence to just show that, you know, we're just not very good at making these kind of consistent decisions, which is what you need from a judge.
Well, if we do hand that judgments over to machines and machine learning, can machines also develop biases?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the consistency problem, you can minimize by using algorithms. You can make your algorithm very consistent, but it's still going to make mistakes, and it won't necessarily make those mistakes in the same way for all people. And one of the big problems with all of this is that when you're building these algorithms, you're building them using data. You're using information about what happened in the past. And there's a bit of a problem there, which is that our past, you know, has bias in it, right? There's sort of historical societal injustices in terms of the way that people have been treated, you know, in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of all different kind of things, socioeconomic backgrounds, all different kinds of ways that people have been discriminated against in the past, both deliberately and unintentionally. And if you're using that as you're kind of feeding that into an algorithm and saying, this is how the world works, and this is how we want you to make your predictions, then you really risk sort of perpetuating those injustices going forward.
So where do we find a happy medium in the justice system? How can we use technology at its best and humans at its at their best?
Well, so I think it starts by accepting that you're never going to have something that's totally perfect. I mean, we started this conversation, you know, a little while ago, half an hour ago or so, saying that even if you forget about algorithms for a minute, you can't think of a sort of a system in the world which is perfectly fair. It just doesn't exist. There's always going to be some kind of unfairness. And I think part of this is by just accepting a little bit that you're not going to have perfection. So by not throwing away everything just as soon as it shows any kind of flaws. And because the problem is that you can say, well, look, these algorithms are biased and that's not good enough. But you have to remember that if you get rid of them and you leave it just to humans, I mean, they're probably more biased and certainly a lot more inconsistent. So I think that you know, part of this, there is sort of hope in all of this. You can kind of tweak your data to make sure that your algorithms aren't just repeating what's happened in the past. There are ways to do that. And an example I like to give of this that sort of illustrates the point is that if you do like a Google image search for math professor, basically every face that you see in the Google images ends up being a white male, right? Which is kind of what you would expect. But it's also what the world really looks like, right? I think 94% in Britain, at least, of math professors are indeed white men. But I think that, you know, you can tweak that data if you wanted to. If they wanted to, and I don't actually think they should, but if Google wanted to, they could tweak what you see to prioritize faces of other people to make it, you know, appear fairer, right? So that your technology isn't just a mirror. It's not just reflecting the world that you live in. It's reflecting a version of the world that you want to live in. And you can do that with the algorithms in the justice system too. You can tweak things so they reflect the world you want to live in. But as for what that world we want to live in looks like, I mean, that's a whole nother question and one that you can't really ask algorithms to answer.
And that's inherently a personal question, too, because everyone mm-hmm. has a different perspective, a different outlook.
Of course. And I think it's a political question, too. You know, it's really, I think that's what's, for me, so interesting about these algorithms. You know, on the one hand, they are just these technical bits of code that feel very alien to us. But on another hand, they really do cut to the heart of exactly who we are, what we believe our world should look like, and how we want to build our future. You know, I think there's something inherently human in this kind of discussion about how much we let our algorithms control our future.
Hannah Fry is with us. She's the author of the book, Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how algorithms are used? Are you ever concerned by how much your computer or your social media feed seems to know about your preferences, about what's on your mind, about what you may want to buy? What apps or features of algorithms do you love, though, that help your life? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Hannah, you say that algorithms can really talk a big game. They can make lots of claims, and some are junk algorithms. And you have this litmus test, so to speak, to really test the validity of an algorithm. Can you walk us through that test?
Yeah, well, I get increasingly annoyed by more and more companies just claiming that they've built this amazing piece of artificial intelligence or whatever. And it's just total nonsense because people can say whatever they like and no one holds them to account. So, for example, there was a company that do your expenses a little while ago. And you could take your photo of any kind of screwed up receipt that any kind of a screwed up piece of paper, just take a photo of it and it would automatically upload it to this spreadsheet. And it said that it was using this amazing AI fancy swanky stuff, right? And it turned out actually they just hired like an entire building's worth of people who were sitting there looking at your photos and working it out for themselves because they didn't have the software that could do it for them. Right? It's just these kind of bold claims. So I do have this litmus test. It's pretty simple. All it is that when you hear a really big claim about what technology can do, what you should do is you should take out all of the complicated sounding words, right? Take out the words like artificial intelligence, you know, or machine learning, any of those words, and replace it with the word magic. And if it still makes sense, then you need to dig a bit deeper. I think you need to ask a few more questions.
I love it. So looking at the world of medicine, you write that the entire history and practice of modern medicine is built on finding patterns. How are algorithms being used to recognize disease, recognize cancer cells, for instance?
Yeah, and I think I stand by that, really. I think that, you know, so much of modern medicine is about recognizing symptoms, noticing how those symptoms repeat in different individuals, and then finding the cause of that pattern. Now, that's essentially how our modern medicine has been built. So it's the same idea, really, that you set algorithms to work on that process. So where algorithms have done really well recently in medicine is at looking at scans of tissue in the body. So for example, if you have a breast cancer biopsy, the tissue is sliced very thinly, and then a pathologist will look at that slide to see if they can find cancerous cells in that image. And the slight problem, one of the things that we're not very good at as humans, is that we miss stuff a lot, right? This is really, I think, illustrated best by some scientists from Harvard in 2014, when they showed some lung scans to a group of radiologists, right? Professional radiologists, and asked them to look for anything unusual in those lung scans. And 83% of these professional radiologists failed to notice that the scientists had hidden an actual picture of a gorilla inside this lung scan, right? 83% of them didn't even notice there was a gorilla in there. They're so busy kind of looking at this. And if you're missing gorillas, you know, you're often going to be missing tumors, aren't you? It's going to happen a lot. So humans are just, we're really bad at sort of at catching everything. But you really need that if you want to make sure that your breast cancer diagnosis, or your cancer diagnosis in general, is as accurate as possible. You want to make sure that you're catching every last little tumor that might be hiding amongst your perfectly normal cells. So what these algorithms can do now is they have become so incredibly sensitive. They can scan, they can look through these images, highlight areas of interest, highlight areas that it thinks are suspicious, and then narrow down that problem for the human to come in and say, that one's fine, that one's not fine, and just really kind of offer that diagnosis. And it leads to just a much, much more accurate diagnosis overall.
We're looking at the way algorithms shape our world and the world of medicine as well. The author of Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. Getting your thoughts, they're welcome, 800-642-1234. How do you think algorithms could be improved? Are you keenly aware of how algorithms impact your own life, your own medical diagnosis, perhaps? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation just ahead on the Ideas Network. Earlier this year, one of the two major airports in Shanghai introduced China's first automated clearance system for airline passengers using facial recognition technology. The automated facial recognition system is in use at check-in. It's in use in luggage check-in and security in boarding. The Chinese Ministry of Public Security started to build the world's most extensive facial recognition database in 2015. We're looking at algorithms in our world, how they function, when, where the coding is headed here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms, and author Hannah Fry is with us. Getting your thoughts as well at 800-642-1234. Do you see enhancements to algorithms that could help your life or the work that you do each day? What is your hope for how artificial intelligence evolves? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Steve now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Hi. Well, I was interested in talking about, it seems that mostly what we're talking about so far is algorithms in a scientific or rational way to come up with answers. But as a musician, music, which has harmony and rhythm, those are algorithms. There's algorithms of how to put things together. And I think in the other arts, it's like that as well. And so what I wanted to say is that as a musician, you can use algorithms, but there's always this feeling at the end that it's your choice. You have to choose at the end what to do and what not to do. So there's always a human element at the end. So instead of giving ourselves over to algorithms and saying, okay, we've made the algorithm, we're going to let it decide everything, we can use it but still have veto power, if you will, or have our ability at the end to say, hey, we have a human choice at the end to make, and it's our responsibility.
Fascinating, Steve. Thanks so much. Hannah, what about the art world and algorithms?
Yeah, I love that question. It's such a good point. I totally agree with Steve there. There have been some examples where people have used, have built algorithms that they claim are just as good as humans at creating music. So there's one particularly famous example, a composer called David Cope, who could imitate music by the great composers, so Bach and Vivaldi. And it was enough that when it was played by a live orchestra, it could fool an audience, right? An audience couldn't tell the difference between real Bach and, you know, Bach that had been composed by a computer. But the thing is that the way that those algorithms work, not just David Cope's one, but lots of these in this area, is that they're sort of mashing up stuff that humans have already created, and they're reconfiguring it in lots of different ways. And I think that there's a real argument that they're not really creating music in the same way that it's not like true, you're not truly composing music, those algorithms aren't. And the thing is that you can create original music. It's very easy to create original music. But the question is, does it sound nice? And this is something I spent a long time thinking about in the book, because what does it mean for something to sound nice, right? What does it mean for something to be beautiful? And I think the only conclusion that I could come to really is that maybe there'll be something, you know, elevator music or sort of, you know, hotel lobby music that can be created by a machine using those kind of algorithms. But exactly as Steve said, I think you have to have that level of human choice, because I think ultimately really true, beautiful music is about sort of conveying something about the human experience. And I think that that's something that you can't take the human out of the loop of. I think there are some things that will always be human.
Steve, thank you so much for the call. Hannah, you spend time in the artistic vein of algorithms and in the impact it has on filmmaking and the choices people use for words in their scripts. Where do we see algorithms there?
Yeah, you know, I was talking about junk algorithms earlier. I sort of think this is one of those examples personally. So there are some companies that claim that they can analyze a movie script and they can suggest changes to that script, single word changes that will make that film more profitable at the box office. Now, I wasn't convinced by these claims. All of the academic, there's lots of academic work into whether or not you can predict how something will do at the box office. So forget about making any changes to it. Just can you predict which ones are going to be the hits and which ones are going to be the flops? And actually, A lot of the academic evidence suggests that you just can't, you know. Maybe you can roughly say which films will do well and which films will do badly, but you can't predict which ones are going to be the out, you know, you can't find the J.K. Rowlings in the pile, right? Or, you know, or the, you know, you can't find those sort of really strange things that come from nowhere. And you know, you just, no one sees them coming. You can't select those algorithmically. There's just no way to be able to detect them. And so I think if you can't pick the winners, then how can you take something and say, well, here's how you change it to make it a winner? It's all very messy. There's a lot of luck involved in making things successful in both films and, you know, across the arts, really.
Well, let's take another call here. Let's see here. We have Jeff in Appleton, who is a programmer and who has dyslexia and thinks programming is a dyslexic type of activity. Jeff in Appleton, can you join us? Jeff, go ahead.
Hi, I am just calling because I actually had kind of a funny occurrence happen here. I was actually at the a Barnes & Noble, and I saw your book, and I really wanted to pick it up. But my problem is I have dyslexia very, very badly, but I'm also a programmer. And I believe that programming, for me at least, a lot of times is a dyslexic-ish activity. And I thought it would be really kind of funny. It could be considered a junk algorithm to maybe take the contents of text and put it in a, reformat it in a way that a dyslexic person could read it.
Because people have tried to do that before. Does it work on you? Have you seen any of those texts before where people have kind of tried to make it?
No,
I think I have seen a couple of these. I have seen a couple of these. Yeah, I think people have tried to do this stuff. But I think it's interesting what you're saying. Let me make sure I understand what you mean about coding is a, or programming is a dyslexic activity. Do you mean that it doesn't matter that you're dyslexic, you still feel like you can do it?
Right. And a lot of times it's like, okay, so same referring to a function or a variable that's in a different part of the code altogether. That is kind of dyslexic in its own. I'm referring to something in the past switched around.
Yes. So here's something that was quite interesting. I was doing a documentary for the BBC, earlier this year, and they put me in an MRI scanner, and they asked me all kinds of logical problems while I was having my brain scanned, right? So there were mathematical problems, and there were kind of like the sort of logic problems that you encounter when you're coding, when you're sort of trying to move things around and fit everything in together, those kind of problems. And they also asked me lots of language problems, like, does this sentence make sense? And what was really interesting was that when you're doing either math problems or logic problems, you're not using the language part of your brain. You're instead using the part of your brain that is associated with visualizing stuff and moving stuff. So you're essentially imagining that you're kind of in that code and moving things around, right? It's not about the words anymore. So, I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, but I wonder if that's the reason why someone who has dyslexia doesn't have trouble with programming when they find other texts, you know, perhaps slightly more difficult. But it's very interesting that you say that, though, about it being a dyslexic activity.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you so much for calling. And Hannah, in the final moments we have for you, where do you see algorithms headed? What are you watching for here?
So I'm still quite optimistic about the future. I think that there are lots of bad things that have happened where people have given too much power to algorithms, but I'm very optimistic about the future still. But I think that the reason why I'm optimistic about the future is because I totally believe that we can build a better society, really, using algorithms, as long as we put humans right at the very center of it, as long as people are designing their algorithms with humans and human flaws totally in mind from the very get-go, and how we overtrust them, how we throw them away, how we take shortcuts, how we're sort of sloppy and a bit lazy, and we like to take the easier way out. All of the things that we do wrong as humans, if that sits right at the heart of our algorithms, I think we've got a lot to look forward to.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hannah Fry is an associate professor in the mathematics of cities at the Center for Advanced Analysis at University College London. She's a contributor and presenter for the BBC and author of the book Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. Just ahead, we talked with the author of the Great Minnesota Cookie Book. You're with us on the Ideas Network.